Cool, Marco. So welcome, hello everybody, for this unusual time cafe club. The speaker today is being invited, suggested invited by Guylaine. He's a researcher at Caltech. Well, CV is definitely interesting. I discovered that Marco started his career as mechanical engineer before doing a master in physics and then in at UPenn and then the PhD in astrophysics in Toronto. He got a postdoctoral scholar at Caltech for 4 years. And then he got a Kavli fellowship in astrophysics at Stanford for all the 4 years working on the line intensity mapping, let's say. Then he moved to the private sector, right? As data scientist for a company. I'm really interested in what you did there. I'm reading your CV, the section I'm most proud of, designing of a carbon fiber road bike frame. And then in 2021, he came back to science as a senior research scientist at Caltech again, where he's leading the Spheric Space Telescope Detector Calibration. And that's it. So Marco, please, when you're ready, you can start and invite everyone to interrupt him at any time for questions, please.
Thanks for that, for that flattering introduction. Yeah, please, like Carlos said, interrupt me at any time. I made this talk short and fun, so interruptions are going to be part of the show. Okay, so I feel like the origin story of this paper is important because it never was meant to be a paper at all. I went back to my emails and looked, and it was June 7th that I got an email from a professor. She asked for my code for SimStack in Python in IDL, and I said, I don't know. I don't know where my IDL code is. I don't even remember how IDL works. I really insist that you use my the Python code that's on GitHub. It's very easy to use. Very, very, very easy. I kept telling her. And so then I went and tried it myself because it's been years since I used it. And I couldn't get it to work. It was in Python 2, it was not compatible with Python 3, and it was confusing, and it was a mess. So I realized that if I wanted people to use it, I needed to clean it up. So I started to clean it up, but it was not trivial. It was not easy. So I let it go for a while. And then 6 months later, Christmas holidays came around, and I don't even know why. I just decided to start again. And I really got focused on it and managed by the end of the year to have a new version completely redone, and working and released. But it wasn't supposed to be a paper, and that all changed when I started testing it just for fun on the new Cosmos catalog, and then I got some interesting results. So we're going to get to that part in a bit. Okay, introduction. So what is it we're trying to do here? Well, so if you look at this galaxy, in the optical and the infrared. A moment, I'm looking to see if I have a mouse here to point at stuff. I guess not. Okay. You look at a typical LCD, it's got an optical component and an infrared component, right? And they are complementary, but they are different, right? One of them traces the stars, the other one traces the dust. And typically the dust regions, which are out on the outskirts there, are pretty good tracers of a star formation because that dust is getting heated by high energy photons that are coming out of star forming regions. We know this story. So why wouldn't you just, if you're interested in stuff from ancient history, why wouldn't you just focus on the infrared part, which is such a great tracer of star formation? Well, we know the answer to that one too, which is source confusion, right? So for people that are not familiar, this is an image here from HST, the Z band. And this is the same image, right? This is the optical component, and this is the same image in the infrared, right? This is at 250 microns from the Herschel spire, right? And you blink them, they're the same part of the sky, but clearly you can't resolve in the same way you can in the optical, right? So what do you do about that, right? What do you do when only 15% of the flux is resolved into discrete sources? And then that even only really represents 1% of the sources. Well, one of the things you can do is what I call force photometry decomposition. This is a new way of me describing SimStack. So let's see if it works. Okay, stop me if you get confused. So if you look at this spire image, right, the blue contours, and you try to get a source out of it, or you're going to get this one object, right? But if you have you have positional priors, right, you might be able to figure out that this source, which is actually composed of, you know, in this example, of two objects, right? If you have positional priors, you can do a better job of getting the flux of those, of the actual the reality of the objects that are composing that flux. Simple so far, right? Gets more complicated, but right now, this is the basis of SimStack, right? One thing that I do want to point out, because it's going to come up later, is that if you don't have all of the objects to do your positional priors, and you then there's a risk that you can be biased, right? If you try to get the flux like this, then you're going to get an answer that's off. So the sky, right, it's actually, of course, it's two dimensional, and it's made up of many objects, so it's going to be bumps and wiggles everywhere, right? So if you think about the sky in the same way that we just had, it's made up of a whole bunch of objects, right? And they're going to be different fluxes. They're going to be some very massive, some very bright, and some very faint, lots very faint, right? And you can... you can think of it, you know, as a distribution of objects, right? All kinds of luminosities and masses and so on. But you can roughly divide them up into different categories, right? So here I've categorized them by stellar mass. And I say, well, you know, these are the ones between 9.5 and 10, 10 and 10.5, right? And then you can go to the next step and you can say that the different categories are roughly exactly the same, right? You follow that step, right? So I've divided them up by stellar mass in this case. And then I've approximated them as equal in the actual image. And at that point, once you've made that approximation, then you can decompose the map, right? In the same way as before, where you are doing that decomposition of that one object, right? So here I'm decomposing the whole map into different layers. Okay, so now keep in mind when I say layer, or if I say bin, it's the same thing, right? Right, so I'm basically at this point, this is an example of I take a catalog and I'm dividing it up into a whole bunch of bins, a whole bunch of layers, right? I'm dividing it up by redshift, I'm dividing it up by stellar mass, I'm dividing it up by star forming or quiescent. You know, I could do other things like divide it up by HEM, I could divide it up by other color features. Really, It's up to the whatever the project you're working on. And once you get to that, so here in this simple example, you're fitting three layers simultaneously to get this sky, right? To get this example. It's made up of three layers, but in fact, the full sky is made up of all the objects, right? And so if you got a full catalog, then you would divide that up into whatever layers you want, and then you would fit all those layers at the same time. Okay, so in the same way that I was describing those three layers, now in reality, in this the results I'm going to show you later, I've actually divided up into 73 layers. 73 layers where 9 of them are redshift, 4 of them are stellar mass. It's split into star-forming galaxies and quiescent galaxies. And I had one more layer, which is the foreground layer, which is actually just empty. If you want to know why, we can talk about that later. It's not that important. So the fit at this point is 73 layers, right? How many layers is the maximum is still a question I'm not really sure the answer to. I think it depends on the signal to noise of the image and the signal to noise of the of each of the bins or each of the layers that you divide it up by. But it's definitely can do this without any problem. And I think before I move on, I should pause for questions, because this is the hardest concept to understand, but it's not that hard, I hope. We're good? Okay.
Sorry, I have a very nice question.
Yeah.
Sorry, what's on the X and Y axis?
This is an approximation, right? This is a one-dimensional slice of a two-dimensional image.
Yeah.
Right.
Of the image. So it's a cut of a line in the image. That's it.
Yeah.
So it's the flux we measure along one line in the image.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. So the fit here, it might not be clear, but the fit here is each of these layers, I'm getting one number and I'm getting the flux, right? I'm getting the amplitude of this object in each of the objects, you know, in each of the layers. Right, so here I'm getting, in this imaginary example, I'm getting three numbers, right? I'm getting a flux at layer one, layer two, and layer three. And layer one is going to be larger than layer two and layer three.
So is it a kind of wavelet decomposition with wavelets with finite support, which are here represented like Gaussians?
It's even simpler than that. Really, what this is it's two dimensional, obviously. And what you do is at the position of all the objects in your catalog and all the objects in your bin, right? At the two dimensional position, you just put a delta function, put a one, right? So you're
a delta function.
It's a map of zeros, right? The same size as the real map. And at all the positions in the catalog, you put a delta function. And then you convolve that image with the beam of the real image, right? And so now you have here you have three layers. In the next slide, you have 73 layers, but you have each of those layers is a two-dimensional image with Gaussians at all of the positions in the catalog. I think I should put. And next time I give this talk, I should put that slide where you can visualize it, because it's very visual.
I mean, what distinguishes between first, second, third, and the higher layers is the spatial resolution of it. So the details you add on the to recover the original image, I mean, the flux along one axis?
Well, so this is an example. It's always two dimension, and each layer, it's the only thing that it returns is one number, which is the flux. Maybe I'll show you the answer and then you can see what I mean, right?
Sure.
Each layer here is represented by the circle, right? So in this example, you know, in this, the top, the blue line is the equivalent of the fluxes of all of these light blue, most massive layers, right? So at the most massive bin at all of the different redshifts is represented by this top line, this top blue line here, right? So here is the flux at only 350 microns from redshifts 0 to 4, and it's split up by stellar masses, which are the different colored lines.
Please go ahead. We're going to stick here until we can discuss it.
Yeah, I just made these slides. I thought I'm trying to make it simple, but it needs work because it's a simple concept, but it's hard to describe. So I'm happy to take all the questions that we need to get it to make sense. But I'm happy to come back to it. So. Right, so this is what I'm showing you here is from 2013. This is when the code was still an IDL. This is the this is the result from one wavelength. But the actual stack is done at multiple wavelengths, so from 24 microns to 1.1 millimeter. And then from the same bin in each of the different wavelengths, you can construct the full infrared SED, right? And then the integral from 8 to 1,000 microns of this SED gives you the infrared luminosity, which is a proxy for the star formation rate, right? And now for the full catalog, I have a model, an estimate of the infrared luminosity for every bit. So I wanted to pause for questions. We already had a couple, but I'm happy to take more. Okay, moving on. So from the same paper from 2013, we had an estimate of the dust temperature versus redshift, right? And we saw clear evolution from redshift 0 to 4 in all the different mass bins, and we fit it with a line. Subsequently, other people have found a similar trend, right? This is taken from the Schreiber 2018 paper. It shows some results from Matthew Betherman and Corentin Schreiber, and maybe others as well, and saw the similar trend, right? And then you know, the next question is, does this trend extend to high redshift, or does it level off? So before we get to the answer here, why would we expect that it could get hot dust at high redshift? Well, there's a few things that were clearly problems that to get resolved if the dust gets hotter at high redshift. One of them is this deficit in the IRX beta, right? If you're familiar with the IRX beta, it's a way to estimate the infrared when you don't have infrared, right? When you only have optical and UV. But what they were finding is, this was a Nature paper from Peter Capak, that when they got to really high redshifts, that the IRX beta was, there was a deficit, they were lower. But that actually resolves if the dust is hotter, because the infrared luminosity is higher, and then it would align with this, and that deficit goes away. Another thing is that you would resolve the case of unrealistic dust masses that you were getting at a very high redshifts. You were getting dust masses that were so high that you had to have maximal efficiency and no dust destruction in order to in order to explain how you could have so much dust in so much in so little time with these young galaxies in the very early universe. So here, this Bax shows that you can, by changing the dust temperature, the dust mass decreases by a factor of 10. And finally, there was a pretty interesting paper recently that showed that there was a bias from a simulation. You could clearly see a bias against hot galaxies in ALMA. And there's many papers, figures in the paper, but I thought this one was the easiest to visualize, in that the probability of detecting a galaxy at different luminosity bins versus the dust temperature of that galaxy, right? So you fix the luminosity and then you change the dust temperature, and the probability that you can detect that object drops pretty dramatically with an increase of 20 to 30 to 40 degrees. Okay, so on January 13th, I learned maybe it was from Twitter, I don't remember, but I learned of the Cosmos 2020 catalog that had just come out. I mean, I sort of knew it was coming, but it wasn't public yet. And so at that point, I was testing my code because I wanted to see if it worked. I was testing with Hetdex, and then I downloaded it, and on January 13th, I sent a message to my friend and collaborator Lorenzo. I was like, I reworked the SimStack code for Python 3. It's a lot more streamlined and easy to use. I just downloaded Cosmos 2020 and stacked it up to Redshift 7. And I realized, no, actually, I only stacked it to Redshift 6. I'm still waiting for the answer. Right? And so then I get the answer to Redshift 6, and I'm shocked because it's working really well. So it's like, Redshift 6, this is a clear signal. Maybe this is a Nature paper. I'm going to try it to Redshift 7 and see if I can get it. It's like, yeah, Redshift 7 is great. So then Redshift 7, I get a really great answer too. I'm like, celebration time, right? And so the next thing is like, I'm going to try Redshift 8 and see if I still get an answer. And sure enough, I was getting a really strong signal to Redshift 8, and I got really excited. But I definitely need to publish this. So this is the paper now that I'm presenting. The catalog is the Cosmos 2020 from Weaver et al. It's 110,000 galaxies. They offer different photometry and photoZs. And in this paper, we use the Farmer and the LaFar. If the redshifts go from zero they go even higher, but I selected from zero to 10, split it into star forming and quiescent using the NUVRG selection criteria. And then I do the stack on maps at 24 microns, 100 and 160 from PAX, 250, 350, 500 from Herschel, and then the SCUBA II Cosmology Legacy Survey at 850 microns. So similar to what I showed you before, this is half the galaxies all stacked simultaneously. I'm not showing the quiescent galaxies because they do show a strong signal, but they're not really the focus of this paper. So these are the star-forming galaxies, all stacked simultaneously out to redshift 10. There's some funny things going on here that I'm still trying to understand. The referee report actually just arrived, so it's time again to start thinking about it. Some of the funny things are the increase of galaxies at the highest redshift then doesn't really make any sense. It's probably due to interlopers, and I'm going to have to figure out how to deal with that. But yeah, strong signal. One of the things that I did in this is I plotted the model from the Schreiber paper as this very thin purple lines to compare what the expectation would be if you just extrapolated what we know from redshift 0 to 4. And notice that there's a pretty clear departure as you go to higher redshifts. And when it comes to dust temperature, there have been other high redshift dust temperature estimates. Most of them have actually been found to line up with the extrapolations from the Schreiber model, but there were a couple of exceptions. Hotter objects at redshifts 8.5. And so there's a bit of a question of what is it, right? Is it an extrapolation or is it hotter or what's going on? So now after we get the stack, we find that in fact, if you're looking at the aggregate temperature, there's a clear increase that is in excess of a simple extrapolation from redshifts 0 to 4. Right, and it's worth pointing out that this same stack agreed quite well from 0 to 4 before the excess kicks in. The obvious question now is it real, right? Because it's definitely different. One of the questions that I'm still working on is what is the effect of interlopers? Interlopers means that I have a catalog and the catalog gives me photo Z's, right? Redshifts from the catalog, but those photo Z's might be wrong, right? Redshifts are known to fail catastrophically. So something that's at redshift 1 in the catalog says it's at redshift 10, right? And so if it's really at redshift 1, it's probably much brighter, right? And so if that's true, you don't need that many interlopers to boost your signal. But I wanted to know, well, how much of that is necessarily true? So I made the simulation. It's a pretty busy plot, but the idea here is on the x-axis, I have the interloper percentage. And on the y-axis, I have the difference in temperature that I would get. And the colors represent the redshift and the stellar mass of the interloper in question, right? So if I have, so the red one is basically redshift 0, right? So if the interlopers are local galaxies, they're really bright, And the more massive that they are, the fewer that I need in order to shift the temperature. And so realistically, if I do have interlopers, they're probably not at risk of zero, right? Because if it's going to be a strong signal, the photoses are going to be pretty good at getting being able to catalog those. So it's probably going to be something more intermediate redshift. And if it is at intermediate redshifts, let's say redshift one, at a stellar mass of 10 to the 10, which is already pretty massive, I would still need to have an interloper fraction of 30 to 50%, just to shift it by 10 degrees. So it's I still think I need to do a better job than this, but I'm pretty confident that even though there will be interlopers and that they will be something that I have to deal with, they're not going to shift the answer by a significant, enough to align the temperatures with that extrapolation, basically. So the answer probably lies somewhere in between.
I have a question. Technically, you have to assume also how intrinsically bright are the distant sources to know if the interlopers will play a role or not. Because if they are so faint that you expect very few signal from them, even if they have really 50% of the sample, the impact could be higher if they are less bright. So how you expect them to evolve also in terms of luminosity and temperature can impact what you really have. So the null hypothesis is not obvious in this case. So maybe by doing this plot, you may underestimate a bit the impact. And another question I have is like the number density of like ultra star forming objects you had, like typically it was like more than 100 objects in Cosmos between 9 and 10 is really a lot compared to expectation. So could you, if you have 80% of interlopers, how bad it is it?
Well, I agree with you, but with the case of the faint sources, I think that that's built into the simulation, right? I think if I were to rebuild the simulation so that everything in high redshift was extremely faint and every interloper was extremely bright, then I think I would get a different answer. But I also don't think that's realistic. As for the number density of very large objects at high redshift, it is definitely a concern, right? I have a feeling that one of the things that it's going to end up being coming out of this is that I'm going to have to abandon the 8 to 10 redshift bid, just because doing that job is a big job, I think, and that's probably the job for the Cosmos people and not me, right?
I think it's JWST will address this question. I think there is lots of bad objects. I agree with you. When stacking your input catalog, at some point you cannot make miracle if the input catalog is not good enough.
Right, but you know, in the opposite way, you know, if the Cosmos people were to embrace this, they might be able to use this as a tool to help them figure out what's going on. Right, this could be extra leverage for getting a better handle on the photometric regions. Okay, other things, I redid the stack restricting it only to the ultra deep stripes in the Cosmos region. And I got consistent results, right? And so the point here is that I would expect that the photometric redshifts are gonna be better because it's deeper and I'm gonna have fewer outliers. So then maybe the answer would drop, and it really didn't. So, I mean, that tells me that the ultra deep, for one thing, is not doing a much better job of eliminating outliers, interlopers. But I really need to quantify this because I got consistent results, but I didn't do a deep dive yet. Because of course it's a smaller region, so the error bars also do go up a little bit. And then finally, there is the question of the SED, model SED, which is, it's a modified black body, right? The on the wean side, I have one, I stitch on one power law. On the Rayleigh gene side, I stitch on another power law. They are fixed. And one of the things that could present a problem is the fact that you have these PAHs at, 10 microns, basically, that are moving through the model SED in such a way that there are some places where it rises and there are other places where it dips. And probably the best thing to do, and I've already experimented a little bit with it, and it does seem to make a little bit of a difference, actually on the quality of the fit, if nothing else, the downweighting the 24 micron point. So what I think I'm going to end up doing is selectively downweighting it depending on where the pH peaks and troughs are with respect to the band. But that's an extra job that I haven't really done yet. I haven't so far noticed that that makes any difference on the temperature though. Okay, well, so it seems like this hot dust is real. And we have good reason to expect hot dust, as I presented before, but why would we expect hot dust? This is another question, right? Simulations show that there are regions of hot dust, and particularly at high redshift, that those regions can get really, really hot. And if you expect the SED to be comprised of a hot component and a cold component, which was sketched out here by Yang et al. In 2019, a higher specific star formation rate, which we also see an evolution of that with redshift, you would expect that the hot dust contribution would be increasing, right? So another thing that I haven't done, but I would like to do, or I would even like better if somebody else did it, is to make a model where the hot and cold components vary with redshift and see how you could break down the SED that way. And then finally, the dust quality, the type of dust at high redshift might be very different, should be very different from the dust that we have in lower redshifts, right? It should be more silicate rich, should be lower metallicity. And those two things make it more likely that the dust is hot because of the efficiency in how it's able to radiate.
Marco, did you try to look at the dust mass?
I did, yeah. There was, it was NMAS letters, so it was only 5 pages. So some things didn't make it, but yeah, I definitely have a figure for the dust mass similar to, I actually don't have that figure in here either, but yes, the answer is yes.
And
it looks reasonable.
Even for the dust mass density?
Pardon me?
Even for the dust mass density of at high redshift?
Yeah, right, because I didn't really take it to the end, so I probably, if I answer, I might even be wrong, but at a very naively it looked reasonable. When I compared it to figures from like Magitus, or I don't even remember now, it looked reasonable. But I'm also, one of the ways that I estimated the dust mass, I'm not particularly sure applies at a very high redshift, because I use the 850 micron rest frame, which I take from the modeled SED. But the problem with that is that the higher redshift you go, the rest frame 850 is actually much longer wavelength, so it's an extrapolation at that point. So I'm not sure that that was the best way to do it. It's similar to in the figure for the star formation rate density. There's that blue curve, which comes from the A50 micron rest frame, similar to that, in that you get a more reasonable looking shape, if that makes sense. Okay, well, so I'm done. Definitely want to encourage people to have a look at the code. I did some detailed instructions so that hopefully it's easy to use. Here I have I'm showing you what the configuration file looks like. Basically, all you have to do is point your code to the path, right, to where on your computer you've put the data and the maps and the catalog, and then define the bins that you want. And that's it. It's pretty simple to do. Okay. I have some backup slides if you wanted to look at that star formation rate density like I was referring to a minute ago. But otherwise, I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you. Matthew?
Yeah, in fact, the star formation rate density was one of my concerns, because if you have so many objects forming 1,000 solar masses per year at redshift 10, you have a very different star formation rate density, isn't it?
I mean, it's not that many, right?
You have 100, something like that? It's the cosmos field, so
per volume unit. I mean, so, okay, hold on a second. It's the CIB. Right? So, the high mass bin here is the red line, right? So even if you completely remove that red line at high redshift, it goes down, but it doesn't drop to 0. You still have a large contribution coming from the redshifts, the stellar masses that are less than 10.5. Right, so I probably should explain here. This is the star formation rate density compared with some measurements and some models. The one that I'm referring to right now is the gray line with the gray and black, the black line with the gray shaded region, right? And the thin colored lines, which refer to those are the contributions from the different stellar mass bins. What I was explaining to Matthew is that as you go to the redshifts greater than 6, we're concerned that we have too many interlopers at the very high masses, because there's just way too many galaxies that have masses that are unrealistic at those redshifts. Even if you remove that red line altogether, right, those colored lines together sum up to the black line with the gray region. The black line with the gray region is not going to drop dramatically if you were to get rid of it. Right. So if you imagine that in reality, what you should be doing is you're moving a lot more galaxies than that. What you might find is that the black line agrees better with the Zavala line there, and that makes sense. So what I'm going to try to do is do a better job of the simulation where I show a full region of what you would expect for different levels of interlopers. Matthew?
Yeah, no, I understand the question, Marco, and sans answer. And I'm just worried by these dusty things above 10 to 10.9 to still almost contribute flat, but the error bars are still pretty high. So I don't know. Probably again, JWST will really help us to see what's going on. Because if this guy exists and are so star forming, that should be possible to confirm it with web itself. Let's see what's going on.
Yeah, it will definitely be interesting to have better. I mean, this is only ever going to improve, right? As photometric redshifts improve, as the areas that get surveyed get larger, I mean, this is only going to get better and better and better, right?
So, Miri photometry, I think, is also a big deal. Like, if they are really so massive, they should be really bright in Miri, which is much less ambiguous and model dependent. And then technically, if people identify this population, I guess some spectroscopy will be done on them, and H-alpha should really help for this sort of object. So I think that will really help us to understand, because stacking is cool, but it's so hard to understand what's going in, especially at this high redshifts. I would say it's a job of Cosmos people now to give us a clean sample. The machinery is ready.
Yeah. But you know, so the longest wavelength of JWST is still like 25 microns, right? So it will still not necessarily help with understanding the temperatures of those galaxies at high redshift. But it seems like, to me, from digging into this in the last few months, it seems like we have really great data at one side of the SEU, and then all the way on the other side of the SEU, but actually the peak, near the peak, we don't really have very much, right? Band 8 and 9, I guess, are the closest that you get, but it's really, really hard to get.
Especially if it's warm like that, as your plot show, which was my initial concern when we discussed a couple of months ago, yeah. It's like it continued to peak at 250, where we never get data from the ground. So that's, yeah, but we cannot do anything about that. But on the other hand, my hope was more on the H-alpha spectroscopy, because that could be a good way to probe the SFR. It's less affected by dust, but currently you cannot do it above redshift level. It's above 2 roughly, but from space, potentially with near spec, you can go pretty far. And these source should, if they are really so star forming and so massive, they should be H-alpha bright. So that's probably the hope. To confirm it. So, probably in 6 months, it will be much more clear. Let's see.
Right. Well, so I guess there's one thing that I wanted to point out. And it's a technicality, and I'm not really sure if I'm going to be able to even explain this properly, but I'm going to try. One of the things that I did, and I explained it in the paper, is that I did the stack in three chunks. I did from 0 to 3, 3 to 6, and then 6 to 9 because of my computer code, if I tried to do it all at the same time. And then I realized that that was a mistake, because if I had interlopers at redshift 6 to 9 coming from redshifts 1 to 3, if I don't stack those bins simultaneously, then I'm going to be affected not only by the interloper, but also by the objects that are surrounding the interloper. So if that doesn't make sense, I don't blame you, but it's a pretty subtle, it's a subtle detail, and it's related to that slide at the beginning where I said, if you don't have everything in the catalog, that you'll be affected by the neighbors, right? So anyway, to summarize, I used the computer, a faster computer. I did all the redshifts at the same time. And what I found is, in fact, that at redshifts greater than 5, the answer did go down a little bit. I was being affected by that, just as I suspected. And this black line at redshifts greater than 5 drops down to agree almost perfectly with the lines of the illustrious and the sides. So look up for that. Okay.
Other comments or questions? No. Well, if not, thank you again, Marco. And let me advertise the next week Cafe Club. The speaker will be Yanbin Yang, and she'll talk about the evidence of RAM pressure stripping of a dwarf galaxy far away from any large host galaxy. See you next week. Thank you again, Marco.